Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you as always. Excited as always. We're going to talk about some science. Dr. Kevin Fulta, what's going on?
Oh, boy. It was a good week, huh?
It was a good week. Yeah.
So by the time people are listening to this, it was maybe a few days ago now that I wrote an article on Genetic Literacy Project. We'll talk about it in a moment. But what a freaking wave of fallout on that damn thing. You know, it's amazing, but it was really, really telling and really awesome. And maybe we'll talk about that. But just the response that you get to appropriately criticizing bad science, the folks who are against it come out in droves, and who come against you come out in droves. And I mean, it is just amazing. The cults of anti-science that are out there. It just is mind-boggling.
Yeah, man. I've learned to revel in it, though. It's like a cool drink on a hot summer day, because when people call you a shill, or they call you corrupt, or they call you stupid, and you got all three of those this week. I was following the fallout on Twitter, and at one point I retweeted the Institute for Responsible Technology, which is the most ridiculous name. It does matter. We'll talk about it in a second, but when you're getting that kind of hate, you're doing it right. You know, you're over the target, you're going to get flack and all that. So I've learned to accept that, I'm doing it right when they call me a shill. So there we go. We're on the right track, man.
All good. And what's really interesting is that a lot of the usual suspects did not chime in. And I thought that was kind of interesting too, because I think that a lot of the folks who have been the ones who always go after me have really kind of backed off. And I think they realize I'm not a good target to go after. because I'm nice back. How may I assist you? If you would like to show me how I'm incorrect, I would be happy to learn. You know, and they're like, I don't know. I just don't like what you said. I don't know. So I think they kind of just back off, because they make them look really bad. This guy today went after me like, you're not a toxicologist and you don't know statistics. And I just said, well, I'll just defer to your expertise. What part of what I wrote did you find not consistent with the stuff? I'm really listening, and I would be happy to hear your constructive criticism. And the guy hasn't gotten back to me yet.
Kevin's following Jesus's advice and going 2 miles instead of one with so funny.
Well, I like to think of it more like jujitsu than Jesus. I take their momentum and use it against them.
Yeah.
Was that a Jesus thing too?
Yeah, Jesus invented jujitsu. It's in the New Testament.
Jujitsu?
Ba-bum-bum. All I'm getting at is that, like, they read about you on USRTK or SourceWatch, and there's that famous picture of your slanted, enlarged forehead, and they're just ready for you to be this corporate evil baddie. And you're like, hey, man, you know, I'm open to criticism. What did you find wrong? And it just scrambles their brain, because they're ready to,
yeah,
you know, it's good stuff.
They stick the tweezers in the electrical outlet and a puff of perfume comes out.
All right. We're gonna dive in, because we'll make these stupid dad jokes all hour long if we don't actually get into our
story. Let's do it.
Okay. So first up, as we've alluded to, Kevin's story, glyphosate detected in 80% of urine. Reason for alarm or deceptive data distortion? You'll never guess what the answer is. Next up, anti-technology activists claim coronavirus outbreaks could be exacerbated by intensive farming. Here's why they are dead wrong. And finally, we finally know how modern dogs arose from ancient wolf populations. We're going to end the week with a fun one instead of all this serious toxicology talk. But let's dive into it, Kevin. What are you talking about in the story here?
Yeah, so this was one that I really, really feel strongly about. So a few days, well, it was actually, you know, a while ago now, that in The Guardian, Kerry Gillam, who is, you know, who has quite a history with writing about glyphosate and genetic engineering, never has a good thing to say. She writes books against the stuff. She writes articles as pretends to be an independent journalist, where she really was just working for USRTK for all these years, who is funded by the Organic Consumers Association and blah, blah, blah. And then she would be the first to call others a shill, right? Well, she wrote this article that says glyphosate found in 80% of people who were tested in urine samples. And okay, that was data from the CDC, and the CDC back in 2013, 2014, for some reason I'm not sure about, but I'm trying to figure out, decided that they were going to test something like 2,300 people for glyphosate. And they took a little bit of their urine and they tested it, and they found that 80% did in fact have detectable levels of glyphosate. And the assay is an excellent one. I think you really trust the numbers. But what does that mean? 80% have it detected. So when you look in their urine, you can find it, but it's there at these infinitesimally small amounts, most likely. We don't know because they didn't report that. They just reported that it was detected, and their threshold of detection is 200 parts per trillion. So what that means is that it's 3 minutes out of the last 32,000 years is 200 parts per trillion. It barely is there. And so my guess is, and we don't know this for sure, but my guess is that most of the tests that they did that came up positive were somewhere between, somewhere around the limit of detection, or maybe a little bit over. And so is this a threat? Is this a risk? And the answer is no. That when you look at that, that's a million times below any of the thresholds for actual risk in terms of what you would imply would be consistent with risk in terms of dietary intake for acute issues. And so there's no risk there, yet she sets it up by saying, this is the stuff tied to cancer. It's linked to cancer. Which that's not true either. I mean, it's tied and linked to it because she made the ties and links. So basically, it's a chemical that's never been demonstrated to cause cancer from molecular, mechanical, or mechanistic or epidemiological data. And she has never been shown to cause cancer. And it's there in levels that are biologically irrelevant. Yet this goes out to 10 million people and has been now spread throughout the media. And it's really sad because it is a very purposeful distortion on her part.
Before we go on, can you just clarify a technical point for me? And I'm sure there a lot of people would want to know too. When you say that something is at or below the limit of detection, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so the limit of detection is a technical issue. Every single molecule that you're trying to detect, and you have to think about this, you're taking urine and you're breaking this thing into its components, like the asparagus smell, you're breaking this thing into its individual components. And when you do that, you can find glyphosate because we know exactly what its mass is and its characteristics, hydrophobicity, like the way it ionizes. We know exactly what glyphosate is. It's been studied ad nauseum. And so the tests to detect it are extremely sensitive. And when you're saying that this thing can detect parts per trillion, this test can faithfully reproduce something in three minutes in the last 32,000 years. That is how sensitive this assay is. And it's good and it can do it. At the limit of detection means that when you start to get below 200 parts per trillion, you might detect it, you might not, but you can't have confidence that it's there because it doesn't rise above the noise in the assay. And there's other ways that you can fix that and kind of hone it, but really 200 parts per trillion is pretty damn good. I mean, you're looking at something that is on the edge of not there. And so it's amazing that you're able to detect this at all at that level. And I mean, I think it's a testament to how safe our food is and the extraordinary monitoring that we can do to demonstrate that.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem is that the dark side has taken advantage of analytical chemistry to just point out all the places we can find stuff without supplying the context. And that leads me to my next question, I guess my next observation, and then I want to hear your thoughts. And you point this out briefly in your piece, which is very good. I hope everybody reads it. But the fact that you find some kind of a substance in your urine, it doesn't mean anything. That just means that your kidneys are functioning properly, because your kidneys eliminate excess water and waste, things you don't need, from your bloodstream, and then you pee it out. So the fact that you find a chemical in urine, it doesn't mean anything, and it's really obnoxious when you see Gillum or you see the Institute for Responsible Technology or any of these other activist groups or high-profile figures. They treat this like this is an amazing discovery. It would be sort of like saying that, you know, modern vehicles through their tailpipes emit CO2. The horror, you know, it's like, but it's like, well, you can't, as you were saying, if you don't know how much is coming out the tailpipe, just observing that it comes out the tailpipe doesn't really mean all that much. So maybe just for a little more context, right? I mean, things show up in your urine. That means your system's working the way it should.
Well, it's also a residue, literally, of the fact that we understand glyphosate's pharmacokinetics extremely well. And its pharmacokinetics are, we understand how it goes, where it goes, when it goes in. So if you were to consume a little bit of glyphosate, we know that 95% of that is going to show up in urine and stools, and 5% is turned over by a specific enzyme called a cytochrome P450 in the liver. We know that. And so we know that when you're seeing 95% in the urine, when you're seeing it in the urine, it means that the vast majority that you have taken in is now out of your body, which is where you want it. And you know, any compound that you would claim doesn't belong in your body knows and gets rid of, either by breaking it down or by peeing it out or pooping it out, whatever. But this is a perfect example of, if you are worried about herbicides, you're worried about that kind of thing, you want to find it in your urine. The problem would be if you're taking it in and not finding it in your urine. That means these kind of more fat-soluble things like old school, organophosphates, organochlorides and stuff, that stuff is fat-soluble and accumulates in the body. And that's why it's problematic. Glyphosate goes right through.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. One other thing I wanted to add, and this wasn't directly addressed in your story, but it arose from the article you're responding to. This is the one-man band at the Institute for Responsible Technology, our old friend Jeffrey Smith. The dance instructor turned apparently agriculture expert. He retweeted this the Guardian article, and then he quotes a former CDC employee. I don't know who this is, but this person says, children are more heavily exposed to pesticides than adults because pound for pound, they drink more water, eat more food. This is a great example, I think, of what's known as being factual but not truthful, Kevin. Because it's technically true, right? Their kids are smaller, so pound for pound, you know, the amount of food they eat is going to have a more significant impact relative to an adult. But the overall exposure for consumers to pesticide is so small, as you were just alluding to, that this is really misleading. I would go beyond. This is just a blatant lie, you know, because the implication here is your kids are at risk from all this glyphosate that we're detecting, and they're smaller, so it's going to have a greater impact. And that's so disingenuous, because we've talked about the USDA's pesticide data program results on the show. We've talked about the FDA's total diet study. There's all of these monitoring studies that look at heavy metals and various pesticides and chemicals that show up in the food supply. And they consistently show that the risk is low, even for children. And regulatory agencies pay particular attention to children's health, because that's what everybody's concerned about. You know, I have a kid. Lots of people have kids that work in the sciences, and they don't want people to get sick. So IRT is being blatantly dishonest here, and it makes me mad.
Now then, but that's on brand for IRT. And and the other thought too is, you know, the average kid, if you had a 5-year-old or whatever, you would have to consume you know, 55,000 juice boxes of high fructose corn syrup before you would begin to see any effect from the glyphosate. And after 55,000 juice boxes, you'd probably have other issues that you would be concerned about. And so it really is a non-issue. And the worst part in the article is that it isn't, when you look at it as journalism, you know, and you're a journalist, you like this, what you do. And the idea is you write something and you say, well, let's talk to the people that are involved, not for false balance, but for the experts that know this stuff. And she simply talks to the people in her Rolodex who are the folks that are in the anti-glyphosate camp. And they all go, oh, this bad stuff. Oh yeah, that's disturbing. That's concern. And doesn't ask anybody from the CDC who did the data, doesn't talk to anybody who really works with this in a regulatory context. And it really is a disingenuous article. And the sad part is that for me is I wrote a critique that wasn't inflammatory. I was pretty straight shooting. And everything online is, well, you just are a shill, including Carrie Gilliam herself, who wrote the article, who said, you cash in checks from Bayer. Hold on a minute. The point is like, if you find something wrong with my analysis, let me know. And let's talk about it. And let's have an honest conversation. And let's figure out what's right and wrong here. The problem is that I caught them again, and they don't like it. So instead of having a good, honest conversation, they, you know, post all the same old garbage they've said about me for decades. And not only is it boring, I think it further illuminates who they are and what they really are about. And I really hope that folks who are listening today take a look at that and share that and let people on social media know, you know, if they can't argue the points of the factual points of the article, then why are they trying to do a takedown of the person? And it's the oldest trick in the book, and it stinks. So I'll just leave it there.
Very good. You reminded me of a few things I wanted to point out before we move on. The first is that, alluding to your juice box example, your kid's diabetes would give their diabetes before the glyphosate in the juice would cause any problems, you know, just for a little bit of context. Same thing with alcohol. I'm sure all these people go to cocktail parties where they drink a known carcinogen and then they plot their scandals about glyphosate. So I think that's always amusing. Another thing I wanted to point out is that she, as you know, you said she didn't talk to the study authors. She references Dr. Leanne Shepherd's work, who, as we've talked about before, Jeffrey Cabot, who is a cancer epidemiologist, a longtime friend of the show. Hi, Jeffrey, if you're listening. He absolutely demolished Leanne Shepherd's study, and that was one that said glyphosate exposure increases your risk of cancer 41%. And all that to say, even the people that Gilliam is relying on are doing shoddy work, and you have better scientists, frankly, saying, hey, this is wrong. You're combining results from studies that shouldn't be combined. You're making unrealistic assumptions. You're cherry picking the data that's going to get the result that you want. So from top to bottom, this is garbage. And finally, standing invitation to Carrie Gilliam, Jeffrey Smith, any of these folks, if you want to come on the show and actually defend your work instead of blocking us on Twitter, come on, let's do it. I think that would be fun. I don't think they will. But,
yeah, same with Talking Biotech. I mean, I would love to have any of them on.
Didn't he back out of an episode of Talking Biotech with you?
No, they actually contacted me and say, Jeffrey Smith wants to get on with you. And I thought, awesome, he's going to come clean in front of everybody now. And we're going to, you know, I mean, I was so excited because I just wanted, you know, I was really excited. I was supposed to be in a debate with him in 2013 and he backed out. And then his people contacted me and said, he really wants to be on with you and it would be great. And I said, absolutely. And then the day before, he said, well, maybe he doesn't want to be on with you. and I think that his peeps were just looking for high impact podcasts. Cause he goes on with anybody who will give him a microphone.
Yeah.
And he, you know, that weasel goes on with everybody. And he, you know, got on with me and decided, well, maybe I don't want to stick my tweezers in the electrical outlet. You know, he just is, you know, that guy especially. And, you know, I and he's the one who I, I, I just, he's so pathetic, and I feel, I kind of feel bad for him. He's up in Fairfield, Iowa, and the Institute for Responsible Technology is a broom closet in his house in Fairfield, Iowa. You know, it's not an institute. It's like a figment of his imagination. And yet this is where, you know, he has these elaborate garish websites that look all authority. No, it's not. You know, it's the place he keeps his umbrella. You know, and so it's just, so anyway, I always wonder what makes that dude tick. And the funny part is that he, I'm sure he's losing relevance because he's been screaming the sky is falling for 20 years now, and the sky is still damn well up there.
Final thought regarding the shill gambit that people throw at us. In a moment of weakness a few months ago, I had a commenter, and I was just not in the mood for it. Someone, you know, typical corporate shill, Cameron, way to go. And I said, you know, Monsanto could have bought me a mansion in Bel Air, and it wouldn't change the fact that you have your head shoved up the region where the sun doesn't shine. It, like, the facts are not contingent upon who pays anybody's salary. It just doesn't work that way. I know these activist groups have been in this sort of, like, they've been bathed in postmodernism for so many decades, where if you just point out that the guy you disagree with gets money from the wrong people, then by default, you can't trust them. World doesn't work that way. 2 + 2 = 4. And it's still 2 + 2 = 4 if Monsanto gives me a check or not, which they don't, by the way. I would appreciate one. I have a 17-year-old Lexus Monsanto. If anyone's listening, I'm kind of tired of having an old car. So if you want to hook it up, let's do
well, let me just jump on that too, is that, you know, the other side of that coin is, and I think the reason they play that shill card so hard is because that's what motivates them. For them, it's about ideology, but it's also how they make their living. And whether you're Gillum, who's selling books or writing stories for papers or working for USRTK, you know, that's where her paycheck comes from or came from or whatever. USRTK, they get paid more the more they throw people under the bus. Non-GMO project, they get paid more the more fear they create. For me, I get paid the same no matter what. And you know, I mean, I pound a check from the university and part of the public university system. And, you know, whether I do podcasts or do whatever, it's immaterial. You know, it doesn't matter. So it's kind of weird that the people who, or it's not that hard for me to believe that people feel that money motivates, because it's what drives them.
Very good point. I like your psychoanalysis. You just went all Freud on everyone, and I like it. That's a point I've made before. I've heard people are afraid to make that observation, but it's just so readily apparent, right? That they, you know, their decisions are motivated by who gives them money. And so they must assume that, you know, that's the same thing. It's like, well, not really, because there's no benefit in me lying to people. And I get in trouble if I lie to people. So I don't want to.
I lose my job and my reputation.
Right.
And, you know, so it's, you know, for me, I can't be wrong, and I go out of my way to not be wrong. You know, I don't have to always be right, but I can't be wrong.
Yeah. It's just integrity, you know, don't assume the worst in people, but we'll stop there. I just wanted to point that out, you know.
Yeah, good.
I could have been created in a Monsanto laboratory. It wouldn't change the facts. Okay, Kevin, speaking of anti-technology activists, are we threatening a new coronavirus outbreak if we keep industrialized farming, quote unquote?
Well, this was an interesting article by Harriet Bartlett that came from an article that her group published in the Royal Society. It was really nice work that's done. And she's from the Departments of Zoology and Veterinary Medicine at University of Cambridge, which is a wonderful place to be. And she talks about this idea of what's the truth about zoonotic transfer and what are the agricultural practices that we engage that maybe support or do not support zoonotic transfer. And this came into our immediate purview with COVID and the discussions of the origins that, you know, you and I had. Did this come from a bat at a wet market? Did this come from, whatever? What we do know for sure, and if you look back through SARS, the original SARS, if you look at MERS, which came through a camel intermediate, if you look at these cases of zoonotic transfer or transfer from animal to human, does that increase as we farm? And it always has been a discussion that as we begin to move into natural areas and displace wild animals, that we decrease the interface between what we do and where the animals that carry these viruses are. So it kind of would de facto increase our likelihood of susceptibility to contract or come in contact with these diseases. Ebola is a great example. They, I believe they know who patient one was who butchered a bat that contained the virus. So the question in this particular article really switches down to one of two camps. And the question is, are these emerging infectious diseases caused because they're you're farming cattle or other types of livestock, or is that helping? And the reason that either makes sense is because of this. If you have a concentrated livestock operation, you're putting all those animals close together and you're not infringing on the larger land. You're not going cutting down a rainforest so that you can have extensive grazing areas for free-ranging cattle over, you know, huge areas of grazing land. And so those cattle or those animals, those livestock, are more likely to come into contact with the infected agent. The flip side of that is that when you have things under high concentration, now under high concentration, you use less space, but the flip side, so you're less likely to come in contact with the zoonotic agent, you know, the original pathogen. Yet, if it gets in that population, it can spread very quickly because things are concentrated. So it's these two different viewpoints or these two different philosophies that help to explain what's happening here. And of course, we see the discussion of viruses changing or being used by those who are against farming and high density farming. And it doesn't necessarily mean that things are going to be better if we adopt those strategies.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And it's one that's been made several times since the pandemic unfolded. I would just put forward one caution in these estimates about, you know, we're encroaching deeper and deeper into nature with our needs to produce more food. And that is some of the assumptions that go into the modeling that makes that possible. And so one of the studies the author cited, they're trying to, and she says, you know, if we continue on a business as usual course, you know, we're going to run into trouble. That's why we need technology. That's why we need more intensive farming. But in this study, I was reading it before we got on the air here, Kevin, and one important problem I saw in this is that they deliberately excluded international trade from their modeling. And that's a real problem because it's pretty well established, I think, if you look at the research on this, you need a global food system to sustainably feed everybody. And the reason is that some regions are better at producing certain products than others. And so each country or each part of the world produces what they're good at producing, and then they trade with each other. And this confers a lot of economic benefits, and it also has sustainability benefits because some places, the climate, for example, is conducive to growing corn, for example. And so you grow that where it's best to grow it. Other people don't worry about that. They just buy it. They just import it from people that do grow it. And so what they did in the study is they treated different regions of the world like isolated little economies, and then they estimated what it would take for each of these places to produce all their own food. And so based on a scenario like that, yes, you know, food production can be a problem if you have to keep, if you assume that all these countries have to produce all the stuff they need, but that's not a really realistic assumption. And then you start getting into, well, what is, you know, the average European, how many calories are they going to eat from milk and from eggs and from fish and from meat in 35 years, you know? And there's no way to know that because maybe those people don't even exist yet. And so you have to come up with estimates based on the existing data you have. So there's lots of variables in here and there's lots of assumptions. So I would be cautious. I'm not saying that it isn't a problem. And I definitely am an advocate of using whatever technology we have access to. But sometimes I get the sense that we are inflating the possibility of a real problem. And then we're coming in with a solution that will solve that problem. And we still want that solution. But sometimes I think we exaggerate the risk sometimes. But what are your thoughts?
No, I agree. I think that it is so multifaceted and it's very difficult to make any real conclusion for everybody, some sort of universal conclusion or universal rules that should apply to minimize opportunities for zoonotic transfer. And so I agree 100%. There's so much, and that's why I mentioned both of these hypotheses as to how vectors travel inside populations and why each of these has pluses and minuses. What it means is no matter what you're doing in agriculture, you need to be cognizant of ways in which nature interacts. You know, in the States here, we had bird flu this year. And, you know, that's a zoonotic transfer from one type of bird to another, and it can even get into mammals. And, you know, you have to have biosecurity and make sure that you're not able to, or you're minimizing your opportunities for transfer risk. So it's just good farming protocols more than anything else.
Right. And that reminds me of one other thing I wanted to point out. Proximity to nature and our interactions with wild species, that's important for sure. But another aspect of this is wealth. And the reason being, it's wealthy countries that develop gene-edited animals that are disease-resistant. It's wealthy countries that develop antibiotics and vaccines. And, you know, just look at the COVID-19 pandemic. It was primarily Canada, the U.S., and Europe, and I guess China and Russia too, but the point still stands. It's developed countries that have resources that can mitigate a risk before it really has a serious impact. And then if you do get into a pandemic kind of a scenario, you need wealthy countries with resources to combat it. And so, again, we don't want to focus too heavily on just, you know, how close are we to nature? Is this a bad thing? Are we putting animals too closely together? Because then you're overlooking the ultimate thing, which is that you need a growing global economy. You need wealthy people to fix these problems in any case, right? And this is pretty clear. If you just look at the U.S., right, the poorer someone is, the more likely it is they're going to have long-term health issues because they don't have the resources to take care of themselves. So we know this from different ways. Just another caution for people to be aware of. All right, enough serious talk for the week, Kevin. Let's talk about where dogs came from.
So the article was in The Guardian, another one, but a good one. We finally know how modern dogs arose from ancient wolf populations. And this is Nicola Davis. And really what this boils down to is that there are multiple hypotheses as to how dogs and humans started to interact. And one of them is that dogs domesticated us. And wolves domesticated us. So this an ancestor of the wolf. So something that is non-extant, right? This is a dead or long extinct type of animal that was probably more like the wolf, would associate with humans and would provide the benefit from the humans. We would throw out waste that the dog might like, you know, some scraps of things or whatever. And dogs would kind of flank human populations because they would get a little something. And then at the same time, humans benefited from the dogs being around because you would get maybe something that would alert you if something was coming or would provide maybe some protection for the colony or whatever. And so this became this symbiosis that was the dog gets a little, or the ancestor to the dog gets something and the human gets something. And this was one of the main hypotheses. And it was this symbiotic relationship, which really underlies the companionship that we see in dogs today. And this was thought to have happened classically, like about 30,000 years ago, originally. You can go back and identify wolf remains going back 100,000 years ago. So there's groups around the country. I've spoken with Gregor. Gosh, I can't remember his last name now. But there's a number of groups that have been working on this question. Gregor Larson. But this group in this article, they sequenced 72 genomes of ancient wolves and ancient wolf material that they got from Europe, Siberia, North America. A lot of this comes from permafrost. A lot of this was material they found in caves and, you know, just like you find fossilized or frozen or, you know, material from wolves, and you can get enough DNA to be able to run some sort of analysis. And what they really figured out is that it doesn't look like dog domestication was a single event. Okay. It wasn't just one time that this happened, that there's good evidence that there was a Asian event that happened, but also a Middle Eastern event. And they don't know if this is like two sets of dogs that that were domesticated and came into human control or human, I guess you would say, province. That it may have been that the one in Asia was with humans, and then there was this other population that was going on, maybe not domesticated, but then bred against this Asian one at one time. So the bottom line is that it looks like there has been at least two major events that happened, or two major populations that got together to form the basis of modern dogs, which radiated from that ancestor, which is no longer around, to what we know today as wolves, radiated to all of the different breeds of dogs that we know.
You alluded to this a minute ago, but this is a quote from the first author of the study. His name's Dr. Anders Bergstrom, and he's talking about this domestication of dogs. He says, most other animals underwent domestication after the advent of agriculture. I think it is a very fascinating thing that humans back in the Ice Age would have gone out and formed this relationship with this fierce predator. And you gave some interesting suggestions for how that could have occurred, but it just seemed to me like you had some caveman walk out and he says, you know, hi, angry wolf, we will be friends. You will be my pet. Here is some, steak or whatever they had back then. It's just, why? So is that really what you think it was? Is that the dogs or the wolves were snooping around and the humans were like, here's some animal fat, and they became friends that way, or what happened?
I think it started when they, area of the permafrost in Siberia, they did find a ancient frisbee. No, I think that what it really boils down to is, I think it was at the early, that wolves are scavengers. And, you know, this breed, this type of animal is primarily a scavenger, more than a hunter perhaps. And that it was easy to scavenge lots of stuff around human colonization. And you could always find the goodies around humans. And that symbiosis likely, you know, the animals, if you think about it, when I go outside with a bag of chicken feed, all the chickens come running. And the ones that get there first are the ones that get fed first. And the ones that are straggling behind, they're sitting back there. Same thing probably happened with dogs. They learned that when a human was present, it meant that they were going to get something new. And the dogs that were more bold and confronting humans or coming to humans and not fearing the humans, we kind of selected for this. And what's really exciting about this, and this is a fun way to think about it, is did we domesticate them or did they domesticate us? And so, and because my dog does it all the time, he has me very well trained. It's a two-way street, right? Mutual benefit. And so I really think that is an attractive hypothesis. Just looking at DNA, though, tells us a lot more about what happened in that time. And the other thing that's really neat about this is it shows how wolves have changed, that from this hypothetical ancestor, wolves are really different, and that the wolves before and after the Ice Age are different. And the article talks about how wolves' radiation changed extremely rapidly, and that they moved rapidly from ancestral species or ancestral forebears in Europe around the globe, or at least around the Northern Hemisphere, very rapidly, and differentiated and evolved inside those spaces. So wolves have this capacity to change quickly to meet the environment, and that's reflected in the domestication of modern dogs, which in the last couple thousand years have radiated to a couple hundred different species or different breeds. So really interesting part of Canis, you know, whether you're familiaris or lupus, dog or wolf, that this ability to adapt very quickly is a hallmark of the species or of the genus.
I should have played along with your Frisbee joke a little bit longer and just went into questions like, oh, interesting. What do they make Frisbees out of? Did they have plastics 30,000 years ago? And then maybe we could have gone further with that. That would have been fun.
Go ahead. All right, never mind. I thought we could run with it now, but.
I think I've ruined it because I told people that what we're going to do. Well, next time. Do it again next time, and
we'll just roll with it.
Okay. What I do find fascinating as we wrap up here, I look at my own dog, who is adorable, and I love death. but he's a giant pansy, Kevin. Earlier today, I spilled a little bit of yogurt on the floor, and instead of wasting a paper towel, I said, I'm going to bless my dog with a little treat. So I was like, hey, Fox, come over here. So he comes over, he looks down, he licks one little bit of the yogurt, he looks up at me like, what do you want me to do with this? And it's just incredible to me that you have these wolves that presumably were hunters and were relatively aggressive back in the day, who not gave birth, but you know, my dog ultimately and everyone else's dog descended from this. The diversity that has come from that is actually really interesting.
Yeah. I have a similar scenario. I've got a couple of dogs that are livestock guardians that live here on the farm. And if you walk up to the gate, this guy is 120 pounds, lightning fast, and he will scare the hell out of you if you come up here. But then at the same time, you know, he comes inside during the middle of the hottest days because he needs a little break from the heat, and he's laying there on the ground. He's sleeping and sleeping, and then he farts, and that little noise that comes out of his body, he jumps up and he's like, where is it? Where is it? What's going on? Yeah. He like scares himself away. Like, who's there? I mean, it just shows how prime these guys are. Like, you know, he sleeps with his eyes open. I mean, he's a really, really cool dog. And anything that if something weird happens here on the farm, like a thousand yards away, he hears it and he's on it. It's really, really neat how they've evolved.
Yeah, man. My dog was laying on the floor one time and my wife and I watching TV. And we muted it because it's a commercial or something. And I don't know where it's like, and my dog jumps up and looks behind him, looks, and he's like, what was that? Dude, you farted. Relax. Just chill. That's so awesome. Okay. We're done talking about these ridiculous things.
That degenerated fast.
What do you want? You want formal and polite. Go watch ABC. That's not what we do here.
That's right.
Who are you following on Twitter?
I just have really appreciated Emily Deans, MD, lately. She's an evolutionary psychologist and a very thoughtful Twitter feed, and good with medicine, good with current events, but someone who I've for whatever reason has been kind of front and center lately and has been a wonderful reprieve from the horrors of hearing about myself. So who do you follow?
I'm going to recommend people follow Dr. Alex Berezau. He is the executive editor at Big Think, which is a really cool website, just a large variety of interesting, thought-provoking articles. I saw one today called The Philosophy of Star Wars. Are Darth Vader and the Sith really all that bad? And I said, you know what? What an interesting take on an article. And it's a pretty insightful look at human psychology and how we understand things as being good or bad and so forth. So, at Alex Berezau, Berezow, Alex Berezau. All right, guys. Thank you so much for joining us as always. Kevin, thank you. Have a terrific rest of your week. And we will see all the rest of you next time.